Thank you very much for that intro, David. If we could have the first slide up as well, that'd be great. Thank you. Yeah, really great to be with you kind of this evening. And it's a sort of strange kind of time, really, because obviously we're at the edge of the Christmas season. I've been speaking already at carol services and Christmas things. And then David sort of on one level said tonight was not a Christmas service, but then he opens it talking about Christmas and carols and Christmas trees. You're actually ahead of us in our household, David, that you've got your Christmas tree up. In theory, when I get home from preaching this evening, the Christmas tree will be up. As I was leaving this evening, there was a fight going on between my wife and a six-year-old who really wanted to help put the Christmas tree up, and it was at 45 degrees. So we will see where it is when I get home. But I do, I love Christmas season. I don't know about all of you folks here this evening. One of my favourite times of year is Christmas. The main reason being, actually, that I love Christmas, that it is the best opportunity in the year I have to tell really, really bad dad jokes and kind of get away with it. It's the time when I can really torment my family. And so I've got a whole new repertoire that I'm going to unleash on the family, particularly the kids who have perfected the eye roll already, even at 6 years old. And so just to give you a flavour this evening of what of my family have in line in store for them at Christmas. You can see what you make of this little lot. Why has Santa got three gardens? Anybody know? So he can ho, ho, ho. Yeah. Oh, thank you, one person. That's brilliant. You can come again. what do you call a snowman with tummy ache? Abdominal. And why, particularly for any students in the house, why do you need to be good at grammar to work for Father Christmas? Because you'd be a subordinate clause. Fantastic. You'll be pleased to know we're not speaking on Christmas tonight, and that's the end of the Christmas jokes. But I just thought I'd warm you up this evening. Instead, we're going to speak on this whole question of happiness. And I've just dropped the happiness level by about 20 points here this evening. And hopefully over the rest of the talk, I can raise it slightly. Well, to kind of set the scene for what I do want to talk about tonight, we could do Christmas jokes all evening, but David would probably shoot me. To set the scene for what I really want to talk about this evening, between living in London, where I grew up, which is the accent you're hearing, and living in Dundee, where we've lived for the last 5.5 years, my wife and I lived in Toronto, in Canada, for some years. And I had a Canadian friend there who flew quite a lot on business and whatever. She was much wealthier than I am. So whenever she flew business class. Whenever I flew, they used to fold me up and put me in the overhead kind of bins. And one Christmas, she was flying down from Toronto down to Florida. Canada gets a lot of snow in the winter, and any Canadians who can afford it all go south. They call them snowbirds, is the name they have for them in Canada. And my friend was flying from Toronto to Florida. And because she was in business class and flying with the rich and famous, she ended up seated on the plane next to a former Canadian sports star, a hockey player, who was a household name. If I mentioned this gentleman's name in Canada, everybody would know. There was one particular very famous goal he scored in one hockey match that made him a household name. And there may even be people in this room who, if I did drop his name, would have heard it. Well, it turned out that this former Canadian hockey star was somewhat of a nervous flyer. In fact, that's to flirt dangerously with understatements. He was, in fact, terrified of flying. So in the lounge before getting on the plane, he'd been knocking back whiskies and other hard liquor. While the plane was at the parked at the gate, he was drinking further until the air crew kind of prized the glass out of his hand. And as they began roaring down the runway towards takeoff, he actually, in terror, grabbed my friend's hand so tightly the finger marks went in and began talking, not so much with her as at her. And for 10 minutes, my friend said, he talked about his life and his career. He talked all about his career as a hockey player. He talked all about the businesses that he'd launched since being a hockey player, the vineyards and everything. He talked about his family. He talked about everything. He just talked and talked and talked about all the things he'd done. And then finally, he did actually pause for breath. And so my friend took the opportunity to kind of insert herself into the conversation. And she looked at this gentleman and after all he'd said to her, and she said, "My word, what an amazing life you've had. What an absolutely amazing life. You must be one of the happiest men on the planet." Well, she said the response was quite amazing, actually. She said he went very, very quiet. In fact, he teared up slightly, looked at the floor, and then said very quietly, he said, "No, no, I am not. I am actually as miserable as..." And then he used a word which I won't use in a family setting this evening. And as she began talking with him and trying to explore what had happened, basically it turned out that this gentleman was effectively living in his own shadow. He'd risen so high and become so successful, it was patently obvious, certainly to him, that the only thing that lay ahead was sort of a descent down the other side of the roller coaster. Things couldn't get any better than they had been. The only way was down, and he couldn't really process this or cope with it. See, we live in an age that really does encourage us to find significance and our identity and our happiness in our career and our performance and the things that we do. That's really where our culture encourages us to find happiness. You know, the first thing that we do, right, when we meet a new person, very quickly, usually within the first 2 or 3 minutes, we will ask them, what is it you do? That's how we define people. Social media websites like LinkedIn are designed around this too, identifying people, categorizing us by the jobs we do, by our performance, or by our CVs or our resumes. And the interesting thing is the statistics, the hard statistics, the science itself shows that this approach to life and this approach of trying to find happiness in the things that we do simply isn't working. Since 1993, a psychologist called Tim Kasser and a team of psychologists who work with him at the university he's based at have been tracking what he calls the aspiration index, which seeks to measure people's kind of happiness and satisfaction. And that research project, that long-term, almost 30-year research project, has consistently demonstrated year after year after year that people who put career or financial success, or academic success ahead of emotional or spiritual development end up suffering. They experience more stress and anxiety. They are more prone to depression, substance abuse, narcissism, and a kind of general sense that life is meaningless. The science is clear. If you try and find your happiness based on the things that you do, it simply doesn't work. Now, interestingly, that conclusion is not a new one. The emotional consequences of trying to find our happiness and our satisfaction in our performance were actually first spotted over 2,500 years ago by the writer of Ecclesiastes, one of the most fascinating books in the Hebrew Bible. In Ecclesiastes, the author, considered by many people to be King Solomon, he describes a life that few of us can dream of. Listen to what he says. He says, "I undertook great projects. I built houses and I planted vineyards. I made gardens and parks and I planted fruit trees in them. I made reservoirs to water groves of flourishing trees. I owned more herds and flocks than anyone in Jerusalem before me. I amassed silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I acquired male and female singers and a harem as well. All the delights of a man's heart. I denied myself nothing. I refused my heart no pleasure." And I guess if we were next to King Solomon on an aeroplane, we would want to go, what a life! He must be one of the happiest men who has absolutely ever lived. But then listen what he writes next. He goes on to say, "So I hated life. I hated life because the work that is done under the sun was grievous to me. All of it is meaningless, meaningless, a chasing after the wind. So my heart began to despair over all of my toilsome labor under the sun." Do you know, it's fascinating that in 2,500 years, we have progressed in many, many areas. We have technology. We have healthcare, we have science, we have the ability to find amusing cat memes at the touch of a button. But when it comes to happiness and when it comes to satisfaction, we are still struggling. You know, it's interesting that every week over 1 million Westerners type the word happiness into Google, trying to find the answer to that question that King Solomon asked 2,500 years ago. We may be using newer technology than Solomon, the writer of Ecclesiastes, but the search, the question for where can happiness truly be found is still one that haunts us as human beings. But of course, when we stop and think about happiness and the pursuit of happiness and a better story of happiness, how we find it, all of these things, one of the first questions, of course, that arises is what do we mean by the word happiness? What does the word happiness actually mean? You see, it's a word we often throw around. We throw it around quite casually, but what do we actually mean by the word happiness? Well, it's fascinating that the ancient Greek philosophers, the ancient thinkers, actually explored this question in some detail. And they recognized that there were, in fact, four levels of happiness. If you read the classical thinkers on this, there's a common sort of agreement that actually happiness breaks down into at least four levels. And in order to be genuinely satisfied, to be genuinely happy, we actually need to be fulfilled at each of them, and particularly understand the important differences between each of them. So what then are these four levels of happiness? Well, happiness level one is pretty straightforward. It's basically about the fulfillment of appetite. It's about the fulfillment of appetite. So my tummy is rumbling. Actually, really is, because I haven't had dinner yet. So my tummy is rumbling. And I, lo and behold, I see the donut or the mince pie or whatever takes your fancy. But you see, I see the donut. The donut is great. I have a munch or two and a few more bites. It feels quite good, actually. I can repeat this a few times, but then, of course, eventually it's over. Now, of course, I can have a few more until either the box is empty, I feel sick, or my wife discovers what I'm doing. But it's transient. It is quickly over. Eventually, there is no more donut. And this, all these kind of happinesses that work at the level of happiness level one all work this way. And the thing is this, if you misuse your appetites, you don't actually end up happy, you end up profoundly unhappy. For example, if you misuse food, if you try and use food to deal with things like anxiety and depression, you end up with what doctors call an eating disorder. You know, similarly, our culture is increasingly telling us that we can treat other appetites in exactly the same way. You know, if we're often told you can treat sex in the same way that we treat food. If you feel like it, just sleep with somebody. But of course, the problem is that if you have sex unconnected from committed love, it often and for many people ends up first boring and then perverted, producing not happiness, but unhappiness. That's why so many people in our culture have transient relationships, bouncing from one relationship to another, to another, to another, because they're trying to use an appetite, they're trying to use sex to fill the gap that love was designed to fill, and it doesn't work, and it quickly becomes boring, and on they moved to the next relationship. And if you abuse your appetites in this way, you will simply end up profoundly unhappy. So if you end up ultimately unhappy at level one, the only solution is to move up a level to happiness level two. What is happiness level two, I hear you ask? Well, happiness level two is all about comparison. It's all about having more of something else than the person next to you. I have more money. I have more power. I have more influence. I have better jokes than the person next to me. Some people have called this, in fact, the comparison game. And in one sense, there's absolutely nothing wrong with it. There is nothing wrong with developing a skill and succeeding at it and doing it better than the person next to you. Excelling in sport, excelling at work, excelling in your studies, they can bring great happiness. But of course, the problem is, just like the donut, is it's transient. It can only last for so long. Think of the hockey player on the plane, the story that I opened with. He'd been incredibly successful. He'd been very happy at level two. But now he was slowly moving from being successful to being something of a has-been. You know, one day you will arrive at the top of the roller coaster and face the slow or not slow descent. You know, one day if you're trying to base your entire, your happiness on your academic performance, you know, one day somebody will join your class at university or school whose grades are better than yours. If you're in the workplace and you're trying to perform so well and be the boss's favourite and get, you know, the best results on your team, well, one day someone else will join who is faster, better and more effective than you. And the same is true on the sports field and so on. You know, trying to live your entire life at happiness level two is a recipe for the kind of emotional toil that psychologist Tim Klasser, I mentioned at the start, has been studying It produces stress. It produces anxiety because you're constantly faced with nagging questions. Largely, what happens when I'm no longer at the top? What happens if I'm no longer the best or the fastest or the most successful? And if you try and live your life at the happiness level 2, and that's all you try and do, you will ultimately end up unhappy at this level as well. And if you end up unhappy at level 2, what's the solution? Well, the only solution is to move up a level to happiness level 3. What is happiness level 3? I hear you cry, or I would hear you cry if you were more of an interactive mood this evening. But what is happiness level 3? Well, happiness level 3 largely consists in trying to live for somebody other than yourself, investing your time and your energy, pouring yourself into helping and serving somebody else. And it brings great joy and great happiness, largely because it's not competitive. And perhaps the biggest, the most famous example I can think of would be parenthood. I have a 6-year-old and a 9-year-old, and it's been an incredible journey of parenthood, being able to pour my life, and my wife they would say the same, into serving these two young members of our family. It's brought us great joy. Now, if you're not a parent here this evening, well, you too can still find happiness level 3 through serving others. You too can give your time and your energy and your talents to help others less fortunate than you. In fact, I have a friend back in Toronto who's a doctor. He's married to a lawyer, so they have a fair amount of disposable income. And over the last few years, they've set up a non-profit organization that helps dig wells in poor communities in parts of the world where water resources are short. And they would say the impact that running that charity has had on them and on their family has been tremendous. Not merely have they been able to make a huge difference in the lives of others, it's also actually reflected back on the happiness within their own family. But of course, there is a problem with happiness level 3. Even at this level, there's a problem, because this too comes to an end. This too is transient. If you are a parent, one day your kids will grow up and leave home. Maybe some of you here have teenagers and you're thinking, bring it on. But actually, for many parents, that's a time of great stress. We have a name for this. We call it the empty nest syndrome. And it's a very hard time for many parents when their kids leave home. Equally, if you're pouring your life into helping and resourcing and serving others, one day they will eventually move on. If you do your job properly, they will no longer need you. You cannot be everything to somebody else, because if you try, you will end up unhappy at this level too. But there's a further problem with trying to live your life at happiness level 3, and to use this to answer the problem that the book of Ecclesiastes raised. And it's actually quite an ironic problem, and that is that it's selfish. It is actually, if you're not careful, it can be profoundly selfish. This was actually first pointed out by one of the most famous atheists of all time, Friedrich Nietzsche, one of the most famous atheists of all time, and also possessor of arguably the most impressive moustache in the history of philosophy. And Friedrich Nietzsche famously pointed out, he said, many modern people, he said, help others really so that we can feel morally superior. We think we're helping other people, but really we're just doing it so we can feel better and we can feel superior. And in other words, he said, you're not actually helping other people. You really are ultimately just helping yourself. And if the reason you're serving other people, giving your time and efforts and energy into the lives of others, is ultimately because it makes you happy, then I'm afraid you're not really helping them. Really, you're just using them as a means rather than an ends. And this failure of happiness levels 1 through 3 to really ultimately answer this question of where can we find true happiness leads many people, often around about middle age, to a sort of sense of cynicism. I often meet people in their 50s who are struggling with this. You know, people will say to me things like, you know, when I was younger, I thought there was fulfillment out there. When I was younger, I thought, you know, there was true happiness to be found. But, you know, now I've stopped chasing rainbows. I've kind of lowered my expectations. You know, I discovered personally, actually, how trying to live life at levels happiness levels 1 through 3 can let you down. I discovered that in my late 20s. Was when I first realized this stuff really doesn't work. Back in my mid-20s, I was doing very, very well at work. I was ascending through the ranks at the university down in London I worked for. I'd also started my own small computer software company on the side with a couple of friends, and the money was rolling in. We were doing actually quite nicely. And then outside of work, I was heavily involved in a local kind of youth work charity and feeling very good about some of the differences we were making for young people in our part of town. But something wasn't quite right. I had a nagging sense something was going wrong, because what I hadn't realised was that I was, in fact, not merely burning the candle at both ends. I was burning the candle at both ends, and I'd poured petrol over the rest of the candle and set fire to it. And struggling with stress and struggling with anxiety, I went to see my family doctor, who, after listening to it for a few minutes to what I was going through, asked me to describe to him my typical week. And they're like, this dates this story, because I remember pulling out my Filofax. Remember those things? Few people remember those back in the days before digital technology. And I proudly opened it, and I reeled off all the meetings I was doing, all the stuff I was involved in. And he sat there and nodded while I basically boasted for 2 minutes. And then he looked at me, and my family doctor asked a question. He looked at me and he said, Andy, what exactly are you trying to prove? And to whom are you trying to prove it? It's a darn good question, actually. Because what I was trying to do was to find satisfaction, I was trying to find identity, I was trying to find happiness in my work and in my performance, and I didn't ended up not happy, but profoundly unhappy. Well, if we can't ultimately answer this question of happiness through happiness levels, through things like those levels 1 through 3 that I've described to you, what can we do? How do we solve this quest for happiness? How can we find a better story of happiness than the failures at these levels? Well, let me share with you some more ancient wisdom. We open with some ancient wisdom from Ecclesiastes. Let me share with you some more ancient wisdom. One of the most famous Christian philosophers who ever lived was Augustine. And as a 19-year-old, he read a little tract, a little treatise on this question of happiness written by a Roman philosopher and poet called Cicero. And in his little dialogue that Cicero had written, he explored this question of happiness. And he asked the same question we're asking today. Why is it people end up looking for happiness and missing it? They look for it in all the wrong places. And Augustine was deeply moved by this. And he began effectively a lifelong project to figure out why so many people lack ultimately deep happiness and joy and contentment. And after years of thinking and wrestling over this, he concluded that you need 2 things for true satisfaction. Firstly, you need to love the right thing. And secondly, you need to be connected to an ultimate source of joy and happiness outside of yourself. In terms of love, Augustine concluded that what matters is not what you do, which is what our culture tells us. Our culture says to us, what matters is what you do. Augustine would say, no. What matters is what you love. What you love is the most important thing. Or, to put it another way, what you worship. What you worship is the most important thing. Now, this is the point at which some of you, if you have come as a guest this evening, may be sitting here thinking, well, hang on just a moment. You know, I'm not a particularly religious person, except maybe when it comes to football. Not a particularly religious person. So what do you mean we all, you know, what do you mean about worship? How can worship answer any of these questions? Well, I've got news for you if that's your reaction this evening. The news I have for you is, of course, all of us worship something. Every human being worships something. And for a good insight into that observation, I'd like to read you a very famous quotation. And if you've come to Carrubba's for any length of time, you've heard this before, because David Nixon and I both use this quite a lot in our speaking and our writing. This is a quote I want to read you from a guy called David Foster Wallace. David was a Pulitzer Prize-nominated novelist, not a Christian, as far as I'm aware, an agnostic probably, didn't really know quite what he believed, but he wrote some very insightful essays reflecting on the human condition. And one of the most insightful things on this issue of worship I know comes from his pen. Let me read you his words, and then we'll draw these threads together. David writes, in the day-to-day trenches of adult life, there is actually no such thing as atheism. No such thing as atheism. There is no such thing as not worshipping. Everybody worships. The only choice we get is what to worship, and an outstanding reason for choosing some sort of god or spiritual type thing to worship is that pretty much anything else you worship will eat you alive. If you worship money and things, if they're where you tap real meaning in life, you will never have enough, never feel you have enough. It's the truth. If you worship your own body and beauty and sexual allure, you will always feel ugly. And when time and age start showing, you will die a million deaths before they finally plant you. If you worship power, well, you will feel weak and afraid. You will need ever more power over others to keep the fear at bay. If you worship your intellect, being seen as smart, then you will end up feeling stupid, a fraud, always on the verge of being found out, and so on. And what David Foster Wallace is getting at here is that all of us as human beings make something ultimate. All of us take something and make it the center of our lives. We worship something. And the problem is that if you worship the wrong thing, if you make the center of your life, if you make the source of your happiness the wrong thing, if you try and worship your career or your performance or your intellect or your success, then that disordered love will harm you and actually very probably harm the thing you love as well. The only way to escape all of this mess is to head up one more level, to happiness level 4. What is happiness level 4? I hear you cry quietly from behind your masks. Back to the hockey player on the plane where we left him at the start. How did that story end? Well, after he had shared his misery with my friend and she'd listened to him sort of pour his heart out a little bit, she happened, by coincidence, although as a Christian I do not think there are many things as coincidences in this world, she happened to have in her bag a very interesting book. A book that many of you may not have heard of. It's not so well known today, although you can still get copies on Amazon. Other booksellers are available. And it's called Moonwalker. And it tells a fascinating story. It tells the story of a gentleman called Charlie Duke. And Charlie grew up in a small farming community in North Carolina in the USA. And he'd always dreamed of flying. He really wanted to learn to fly, but his parents had no money for that kind of thing. Well, one day, a new family moved into the farm next door to his family's, and they happened to have a crop duster plane. And the farmer next door was willing to give Charlie flying lessons. Well, after he discovered he had an aptitude for flying, his next dream, going up one level further, he wanted to apply and get accepted for the United States Air Force. Well, that's a pretty tough entry criteria. Lots of people have that dream and don't succeed, but lo and behold, he applied, was accepted, and got to fly these really fast fighter jets. And he made a reputation for himself as a brilliant pilot. Well, then his dreams grew bigger because he loved speed, he loved danger, and he thought to himself, where do I go from here? Well, he decided he would get himself trained up to and apply to become a test pilot, to fly the really dangerous, you know, badass stuff. And again, very, very narrow range of people get selected for that, but Charlie applied and he got himself accepted as a test pilot and flew really scary fast stuff. But even that wasn't enough because he found his dreams got bigger and bigger and bigger. Where do you go from there? Well, this was, at this point, the late 1960s, and the Apollo program, the moon landing program, had begun. So Charlie gets it into his head, well, the next level, going up, 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 is he needed to get accepted by NASA. And so he applied for the astronaut program and was one of a very few select bunch of people to be accepted for that program and was trained and accepted as an astronaut. Well, where do you go from there? Well, his dream, of course, was to be accepted for one of those coveted moon mission places. And again, the chance of being selected to smaller and smaller and smaller, but amazingly, he made it through. And his dream met with success. And in 1972, Charlie Duke flew on the Apollo 16 mission and became the 10th person to walk on the moon. And there he is on that slide behind me. Well, in his autobiography in Moonwalker, he tells the story of what happens after he came back from that moon mission. He comes back to a hero's welcome. He comes back to a ticker tape parade, media fame, celebrity, an audience with a president, back in the days when audiences with presidents counted for something. But then he describes waking up the next morning, a few days later, after all of this noise, and then reality, as he describes it, hitting him with an absolutely crushing blow. Because where the heck do you go after a mission to the moon? How do you top it? and that growing sense that that was it. There was nothing higher to aim for. Almost tore his life apart. He became an alcoholic. His marriage was almost ruined by some stupid decisions he made. And everything looked like it was going to end in a wreck. And then one day, he stumbled into a little country church and heard for the first time the message of Christianity, the news of who Jesus is, preached in a way that for the first time connected with him. And suddenly he describes this kind of light bulb moment when he realized that if the claims of Jesus stood up, here was a basis for his identity, here was a basis for satisfaction and joy that would actually be big enough to support him and his dreams. He finally discovered that his identity couldn't be grounded in performance, it couldn't be grounded in career or fame or adventure or speed, but actually if it was grounded in Jesus, that was big enough to underpin everything. And towards the end of his book, he writes, "I used to say that I could live 10,000 years and never have an experience as thrilling as walking on the moon. But the excitement and satisfaction of that walk does not begin to compare with my walk with Jesus, a walk that lasts forever." And my friends, that was what I discovered too, actually, in a slightly smaller, less dramatic way, back there in the 1990s. As I reflected long and hard on what my doctor had put his finger on when he'd asked me that question about who, what I was trying to prove and to whom, when I realized that I too had been trying to build my identity on work and performance and success, that led me to rediscover the Christian faith in a new way and to discover in the Christian faith a God who offers me identity and acceptance and joy and happiness, not on the basis of what I have done, but on the basis of what Jesus has done, specifically in his work to reconcile me to God and adopt me into God's family. And the even better news, even bigger news than that, is that I can personally report that when you have discovered that, when you've discovered happiness at level 4, with Jesus underpinning it all, then the joy and the satisfaction and the happiness that you find there flows back into the other 3 levels. Because then you can see the whole of the rest of life as a gift of God to be enjoyed. You can enjoy food and sex and career and sport and self-sacrifice, not because they are desperate ways to kind of scrabble and build your happiness and identity, but you can find them as good gifts to be enjoyed. And so my hope for each of you this evening is that if you haven't yet discovered that true satisfaction, true joy, true hope, true forgiveness, true happiness and a satisfaction that come not from what you do, but from what Jesus has done, then maybe just something I've shared this evening will help you perhaps take some first steps towards discovering it. Because as Jesus Christ said, "I have come that you might have life and have it to the full." Thanks for listening this evening. David.
Well, we've got lots of questions coming in.
Fantastic. Now, you were going to answer the questions. That was the deal, wasn't it?
That's not the plan. So, you've described for us this.
So you've described for us, Andy, about how essentially there is, as some people call it, there's a God-shaped hole in us. There's this absence within us that's longing to be filled and happy. A lot of people have asked the question, how would you help someone who genuinely feels, I don't have God in my life, I don't feel empty, I feel very satisfied, I feel pretty happy and content with what I've got in my life right now. How would you help someone like that?
Yeah. The challenge, I think, for some of us, David, is that there are parts of all of our life when I think we can certainly feel everything is going well. You know, we can easily go, "Oh, I don't need God. I'm happy as I am." I mean, that hockey player on the plane story is fascinating, because if you'd looked at the trajectory of that man's life, he would have fitted that category exactly until that tipping point comes. And I think it will come for all of us. For some of it, some of us, it comes when bad circumstances come. You know, you're enjoying a job, it's wonderful, but then it turns out the company's downsizing, you're made redundant. When bereavement or suffering come, You know, I've had several conversations in the last year and a half with people who've said to me things like, you know, COVID is the first time in my life when I've actually been faced to ask some tough questions, because all the things I thought were mattered most have suddenly been shaken. And I think suffering can raise some of this too. And it's interesting that Nietzsche, who I quoted earlier, the other line of Nietzsche's I like, and again, fascinating from an atheist, Nietzsche is also reported to have said, you know, he who has a why to live for can bear almost any how. And it's when those tough circumstances come that you suddenly realize, gosh, if I have an answer to what is life all about and that deeper satisfaction, you can ride through those things. If you're basing your life purely on those performance-based things, that moment will come. And so someone who asks a question like that, I would say, why not just take the opportunity to think about that now rather than wait until the white heat of crisis?
Next question, this one I think you'll be very good at answering for us, because you're about the only person I know who has a PhD in Quranic studies. That's a bit unusual for a Christian evangelist, which
is pretty cool. Yes, I ticked the wrong box on the university application form, and it was only 3 months later I realised this was not New Testament Greek but Arabic.
Well, why not find happiness in other religions / spirituality? What's so special about Christianity?
What an absolutely fantastic question. So the first thing I would say in answer to that question is you can look at what I've shared with you this evening in a couple of ways. One way you can look at it is merely to use it as an opportunity to reflect on the fact if you are not a person of faith this evening, that maybe you need to give faith a really good hard look, and maybe the challenge is you actually need to go out and look at some of the world's different faith traditions and philosophies, because they all profoundly disagree with each other. They can't all be right, and maybe you actually need to do some work. And in fact, I have another Canadian friend of mine who's quite a high-ranking medical ethicist and often spends his time lecturing to other doctors and training them on all kinds of stuff. And he does a version of the talk that I've given this evening, and he will always land it on happiness forward, saying, look, I'm not telling you what you need to believe, but I'm telling you you need something in that level four box. And his John would say, well, he wants to start that spiritual search for people. So that's the first thing I would say. If you're someone who's right outside the Christian faith, maybe the takeaway from tonight is I need to think about spirituality. And by all means, take a look at Jesus. By all means, take a look at Muhammad. I think Jesus stands head and shoulders above the competition, but don't necessarily take my word for it. But then I would say something that goes a little bit further than that. One of the things that is interesting when you do study comparative religion, and I've spent 25 years studying Islam and Christianity in huge detail, is that what's interesting is that where our search for happiness goes profoundly wrong is when it gets grounded in performance. And you cannot avoid the conclusion, as you study the world's other great faith traditions outside of Christianity, they are, with the very greatest respect to my Muslim friends and Buddhist friends and Hindu friends and so forth, those other religious traditions are based on performance. In Islam, it is through performing morally that you find your way to paradise. God has revealed, Muslims believe in the Quran, instructions about how to live. Keep those commandments, you gain merit. Don't keep them, you go down the scale the other way. But the focus is on you. In other religions, such as Buddhism, it's not so much based on performance, it's based on knowledge. You learn and master the right truth. Think the right thoughts. And if you think enough of the right thoughts, then maybe, just maybe, just maybe, you'll find your way to nirvana or whatever it is you're looking for. And Hinduism and all the other religions operate the same way. Most of the world's other faith traditions say if you do the right thing, think the right thing, or have the right mystical experience, then you can satiate the spiritual hunger within. But look where the emphasis is placed. It's on you. You do the thinking, you do the performing, you do the experiencing. Christianity is the only of the world, one of the world's major religious traditions that turns that on its head and says it's not about me and what I do, it's what about Jesus has done for me. And ultimately, the biggest problem facing this world, I think, is performance-based acceptance. Our secular world says perform and you're accepted. Most of the world's other religions, spiritualities, say perform and you're accepted. Jesus says to you, actually, I've done the performance and I accept you. You come to me as you are, brokenness and all, and we'll start from there. And that's the massive difference between Christianity and every other religious option on the table.
That's great, Andy. And let's just keep going on that thread. But we've gone from sort of comparative religion, but let's focus in here. There's a few questions here about how would you counsel and help someone who is an unhappy Christian? And there's a few different ones, but along those lines, but particularly this one. How would you help someone who's a Christian who lacks happiness because they feel they don't worship him well enough or somehow feel a fraud in this? Can you develop that a bit
more? Yeah. What an amazing What an amazing question. And I certainly wouldn't want anyone to be hearing myself or David this evening trying to give the impression, hey, if you become a Christian, everything is wonderful. It's just, life is easy, no problems at all, it's amazing. To go, actually, Christianity can at times, on one level, it can be very tough. It is easy to become quite unhappy as a Christian for a whole range of levels. And Christians are also not immune from some of the challenges that the world throws at you. You know, I've struggled in my past as a Christian with depression, for example, and I lived through 3 or 4 years of finding life incredibly tough going. So just being a Christian alone isn't necessarily a guarantee for life being happy and, you know, full of sort of champagne bubbles all the time. What we're talking about is that deeper sense of joy that underpins it all. But what I would say specifically to this individual, it's interesting the way that you framed it. Two things interest me about the question. The very fact that you talk about being worried about worshipping God in the right way, the very fact that you want to worship God correctly, have that closer relationship, is a good sign straight away, because it shows me immediately your heart is probably inclined in the right direction. If you were saying, I don't give a flying monkey, it's basically what I do or don't do, I'll live my life the way I please and God can go jump, then we might have something, a real problem in the room. But if you are, the very fact that you're acknowledging that actually you want that desire and that connection, that's a good place to start. But then the thing I would also then want to counsel you on is going, remember where your Christian identity as a man or woman who is a follower of Christ lies. It's not in performance. It's not in performance. Christianity does not say, if you get the worship right, if you pray in the right way, you know, log enough hours of Bible reading, do all this stuff, and then God will somehow like you more. God can't demonstrate his love for you any more than he's already done. Romans 5 verse 8 says, God demonstrates his love for us in this. While we were still sinners, Christ died for us. And the fact that Jesus gave his life for you, even while you were his enemy, is the biggest statement God has given. So I would encourage you to reflect on some of those verses in Scripture that really tell you what God thinks of us and where that identity is located in Christ. Encourage you to perhaps share what you've said this evening. Find one or two perhaps mature Christians, friends, members of the pastoral team here who can come alongside you and talk with you a bit more, pray together. But really say, get into your head and pray into your spirit that your identity in God is not based on what you do, but it's what's been done for you.
Could we maybe do two more?
We absolutely could.
The first one I'm going to ask you is one of your one-word answer books, perhaps. Maybe you can add a little bit to it. The question is, does God want me to be happy? And perhaps I wonder if the background of that is that we often hear things that God wants us to be holy, not happy, or it's about God's glory. And so do you want to try and just say something briefly on that one?
Yeah, very good question. I think one of the challenges with the word happiness, and in a sense, the reason we focus on it tonight was I can totally blame David, because David asked me to come and speak on A Better Story of Happiness. So, you know, anything that is wrong in that title is totally David's fault. I do think it could be helpful to perhaps consider separating out the word happiness and the word joy, because the Bible talks a lot about joy. It talks a little bit less about happiness, but we use happiness as the way in tonight, because that's, I think, the search for happiness is how our culture might frame it. If we were going to separate those two things out, one might perhaps begin to reflect on the idea that, you know, happiness does tend to can have that sort of, you know, focus on external circumstances. When everything is going kind of well, then I'm happy. But what's interesting, had the privilege of meeting in my life, you know, many Christians whose outward circumstances are not good. You know, I've got a dear friend of mine right now who is in the process of dying of cancer. There's pretty much nothing that can be done. He knows what is ahead. It's only a case of when rather than if. But he is one of the most joy-filled people you can possibly meet, even though much of his time he's in constant pain. Now, I'm sure if you grabbed him and said, hey, are you happy? He might go, well, actually, today's a bit tough. But if you asked him, do you have joy? He'd go, absolutely. Because his joy is based on something beyond circumstances. And I think separating those two things out can be helpful. That then also helps us reflect a little bit, as David, you've hinted there, or the questioner hinted, that there are things that the Christian faith asks of us that outwardly, in terms of what the world would look for in terms of happiness, do look odd. I mean, Jesus does say, take up your cross and follow me. You know, taking up your cross and following the path of suffering is not often considered to be a recipe for instant happiness. But it is, I would say, a recipe for joy, if joy means actually knowing your identity in Christ, knowing that you are loved, knowing that whatever happens to you in the world throws at you in this life, it can't touch your identity in Christ, and also that whatever happens in this life, we can look forward to as Christians, walking and talking with God personally, face-to-face in the age to come, as Revelation 21 describes. So it can sometimes help, I think, to separate out happiness and joy. And the reason we didn't do that, said in the main talk, blame this guy.
It's always my fault.
It's always your fault. Yeah, that's my motto, David. I got that in mind.
Wade has taught me well that just hold your hands up and say it's my fault, blame me. So that's me. Yeah. This is the last one, Andy. Monday morning is coming for us all here and for you as well. When life gets busy at work and demands are high, what are some practical ways to remind ourselves that happiness is found in God? Give us some help for tomorrow morning.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, Monday morning. I don't know about you, I struggle with Monday morning, especially this time of year when it's pitch black and raining and and it's most of the time in Dundee, but there we are. I'd say a couple of things I think can be helpful, because the way the question's framed, I think, is sobering, because we do live in an age that surrounds us with constant distraction. And for those of us who are Christians, I think particularly in this room, it can be very easy that we get distracted by the things our culture tells us we should be thinking about, whether it's the number of emails in our inbox on Monday morning or whatever it is. So I think a couple of things can be helpful. Personally, this is just how I've done it personally, this is how I've done it myself, is that I've always find, I think, trying to start the day in prayer and in the scriptures and spending some time with God can be a great way to calibrate my day. So I would try and get up, a few minutes earlier than I have to and spend some time with God, because I find calibrating my day can be helpful. Finding punctuation points throughout the day too, where you can remind yourself of that. If you've got a coffee break at work or you during lunch hour or whatever, try and take an opportunity to sort of pray for 2 or 3 minutes. Just recalibrate your day around God can be remarkably helpful. Just put those little punctuation points in. And then I'm also a great believer, and again, this works for me, may not work for all of you, but something I started kind of years ago is I'm a great believer in little quotes on post-it notes. So sometimes it'll be a Bible verse, sometimes it'll be something just to remind me to get out of the routine of my day. So Bible verses can be helpful. So if as I'm reading through the scriptures, if I find a verse that will encourage me around some of these themes, to actually perhaps, write that out. I know the old-fashioned in a digital age, actually use pen and paper and stick it on your computer terminal, that kind of thing. Something to just give you those little reminders that life is not just about what you do, but about who you are in Christ.
Thanks, Andy. Did I see a slide just before this one of the short answers series?
Is there a slide back? Hang on, there we go.
Do you want to just maybe say something about that?
They may need to do that at the back, actually.
Matthew, just take us back one slide there.
Back one slide.
To the penultimate slide.
Oh. See if we get there.
Just further resources that people can follow up on.
There we go. Oh, no. Blank screen. We didn't rehearse this part.
That's all right.
No, there we go. Oh, wow. Look at this. He's going through the presentation. Look at this. This is fantastic. Wow.
It's going to make you hungry watching that donut.
It does, watching that donut. You can tell I first gave this talk in Canada because that's a Canadian donut, but there we are. And wait for it. No, one more. There we are. Thank you very much, Matthew. Oh, no, it's gone. Back again. There it is. Yes. So if people want to follow up, David, thank you for the reminder to do this. So that's the organization I work for. You can see the URL there at the bottom. We do a number of things, but one thing we put a lot of time and energy into is we have this short video series called Short Answers. Where every 2 weeks, myself or a colleague or a friend of the organization will take a tough question about the Christian faith and we'll give a kind of 2 minute answer, two or 3 minute answer to it. So this is a great resource if you are somebody here this evening who is thinking about the Christian faith and exploring these things. Perhaps you've come this evening because you want to, kind of walk around the Christian car and kick the tires a bit. Short Answers will help you think some of these things through. Equally, if you are a Christian here this evening and you'd love to talk about your faith a bit more confidently with friends and neighbours and colleagues, but you wonder, gosh, what would happen if they asked me, that particular question that would terrify me? Again, Short Answers is really useful because you can either kind of learn some things you could say, or even I have friends who, keep this kind of this web page kind of bookmarked on their phone, and if somebody says, say you're a Christian, what about? Just go, well, actually, I struggle to articulate it myself, but hey, I've got a little kind of 3 minute video that might just help answer your question. So the Solas Short Answers video series, and it's free to use. So, please download it, copy it, share it, do anything you like with it. It's a resource we've made available for anyone who could find it helpful.
Thanks, Andy.
Thanks, David.